make the home as much of, in quotes, home as possible, and encourage as much independence on the part of the residents, do everything that we can to facilitate a home like that. And that's always been the philosophy here, that this is their home. The staff, myself, we are here for them.
Hello.
She's been on the job for less than 1 week, but Eileen Montano is already easing into life as manager of the Fairbanks Pioneer Home. On the south side of the city, nestled back in the woods, the Pioneer Home is tucked away from the sights and sounds of Fairbanks, giving the 22-year-old building a quiet rural atmosphere. And it is quiet. Residents are scattered about in various sitting areas. Montano's office is near the front door, so she can step out and greet residents when she sees them pass by. Montano has been in Alaska for the last 15 years, moving here just after she received her master's in nursing. Most recently, she worked as the director of nursing at Fairbanks Memorial Hospital. The 46-year-old New York native says the job at the Pioneer Home offers her the chance to be an administrator, but keep in close touch with the patients.
Because my background is nursing, and one goes into nursing because they like patient contact, this setting does give me more opportunity to be, to develop long-term relationships with the residents. It's an administrative position, and so I can build on my administrative skills that I've learned, but also compared to the hospital where most of my interface was with the staff and it was rarely an opportunity to deal with patients except on an exceptional basis, a complaint or whatever. So this gives me the best of both worlds, I think.
Hello, good morning.
Residents of the Pioneer Home are as young as 63. Some are in their late 90s. Montano is just getting to know them, and she's just getting to know the day-to-day routine of running the 100-bed Pioneer Home.
Hello there. Well, how are you?
Well, congratulations.
Well, thank you.
For KUAC Local News,
nice
I'm Ann Thornson.
Nice to see you, too.
What a lovely place.
Isn't it?
ITA President Donna Gilbert says a petition will be filed with the city clerk's office this week to change that funding method. Gilbert says the plan is to stop dedicating 70% of the bed tax revenue to the Convention and Visitors Bureau.
At this point, they automatically get 70%, and it's the bad part about it is it doesn't make them accountable to anybody. It's an automatic dedication of 70%. It will not cut them off from funding. What it will do is make them be accountable. They will then have to submit their budget to the council and vie for money just as any other nonprofit organization in town.
The Convention and Visitors Bureau Executive Director, Janet Halverson, says since the bed tax was put in place, the Bureau has been funded a number of different ways. Halverson says the dedicated percentage is the easiest method of budgeting and best for long-range planning. She believes the community will support the status quo.
I think that when the hotel motel tax was put in place, the visitor industry fully supported it, and I think there are enough people involved in the visitor industry and who are benefiting from the visitor industry in Fairbanks that they're not going to want to see anything happen to the hotel motel tax and for the funding of the Bureau.
The Bureau's funding method is the subject of a fourth ballot initiative the ITA is planning to get a vote on this fall. The other three things the ITA wants to do are change the city's fiscal year, establish a tax cap, and repeal the increase in the mill rate. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson. 3, 2, 1. A petroleum spill near the MUS power and water treatment plants back in 1968 was cleaned up at the time and again 2 years later. But federal and state standards have changed, and now the city is under the gun to do another cleanup. Benzene was recently detected in two of the city's water wells, and while the level of contamination did not exceed the federal or state standard for safe drinking water, the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation says cleaning up the spill again is a top priority. So City Utilities Manager Virgil Gillespie says while cost of the cleanup is a concern, it's the government standards that are driving the latest effort to solve the problem.
The spill is there. It has been there for years. It's been known by everybody who was there. And while there have been changes and more stringent requirements mandated by federal law, if new laws were to be enacted before we complete this compliance order, we're going to have to comply with those also.
An engineer's estimate for the cleanup says it will cost $1.5 million to get started. That will likely come from a 3% increase in your electric rate, or about $2 more a month on the average electric bill, according to Gillespie. In voting to approve initiating a new cleanup, Councilman Jim Hayes considered it the best alternative available.
Thinking of the alternatives and dealing with the federal government, and from what I've been able to find out from attorneys that are involved in this thing, I think we're taking the best course of action. Well, I don't want to say best, it's maybe it is best from all the alternatives that we've got. So I would urge that we pass it. It's a toughie.
The city says those alternatives are litigation or for the Department of Environmental Conservation to take over management of the cleanup. The city's approval on a 4-2 vote to go ahead with the new cleanup effort means it's committed. Approval of the electric rate increase will come later. The Public Utilities Board is set to consider recommendation of the electric rate hike at a meeting this evening. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. Whether or not smoking should be allowed outside of school buildings, or literally banning smoking on all school property, is what has the school board divided. Currently, smoking is allowed in designated areas only. The board now has before it a policy to ban smoking in all buildings, in all vehicles, and on all school property, so employees and visitors would not even be allowed to stand outside the building to have a cigarette. Board member Andy Warwick says it's simply a matter of setting a good example.
Well, that's really the issue. We tell the kids they can't smoke, both through statute and through school board policy, but we allow the staff to smoke. And in an age where we're trying to discourage the use of tobacco, other controlled substances, it seems somewhat hypocritical to allow the staff, teachers, to smoke in our public schools.
But the board members on the other side of the issue say banning it on all school property is unenforceable. Board member Jerry McBeth.
I don't think that it's really feasible to enforce it outside of school buildings, and inside of school buildings it's going to create a morale problem.
Opponents of the change were also concerned about how the ban might impact employee contracts. The board gave preliminary approval to the smoking ban on a 4-3 vote. A public hearing will be held at the August 1st meeting before the board makes the change official. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton. This is the Teamsters story for air Thursday, July 13th in 3, 2, 1. Last winter, the school district asked the Borough Assembly to consider some different options for the school's administrative offices. The old main building, which houses administrators now, has asbestos and heating system problems that need to be solved in order to stay there. The estimated cost to renovate that building has been projected at around $10 million. Voters have rejected previous renovation plans. So the Borough Assembly is now pursuing the idea of buying the Teamsters building offices. An ordinance calling for the voters to approve a bond issue to do that is up for public hearing tonight. However, Borough School Board members are worried now about the space that the Teamsters building offers. Board member Jerry McBeth says they want to make sure they can move right in and use it.
I don't believe that we can do it right away, so it has to be modified. We don't have facilities over there to hook up our computer equipment. We don't have the kinds of rooms and offices to meet the needs of the staff right now. And it would cost money to change the building. It was not a building designed for the purpose of school district administration.
Borough Assembly member Chris Birch introduced the ordinance calling for the bond issue. Birch says if there is a problem with the Teamsters building, this is the first he's heard of it. Last winter, when the district looked at proposals for leasing new office space, Birch says the district found the Teamsters building and several others acceptable. Birch says this ordinance is one way to get the ball rolling towards solving the space problem.
If somebody's got a better idea, let's hear it. I think it's premature to start taking pot shots at something. I mean, I guess my opinion would be that if there's something wrong with this proposal, either the amount, the square footage, or there's a better and a cheaper or a more efficient structure someplace else, then I'd certainly be open to looking at that. But I think it would be unfortunate just to throw this out the door without taking a good hard look at it.
Money is a key issue. Birch says spending $3 million to buy and renovate the Teamsters building would be more palatable to voters. But about 80% of the bond issue might be reimbursed by the state, and that, Birch says, is also a factor.
There are some that feel that because the state's paying 80%, that we ought to go ahead with as much as we can go for, and I think that's part of the problem. I think that mentality's gotten us into trouble on a statewide and a national basis. I think that we should look for the most cost-effective means of resolving the problem rather than just simply figuring that because the state's paying 80% of the bill, that it's all right to spend three times as much money as we need to.
School board members plan to talk with the borough assembly before tonight's meeting. They want to express some of their concerns before final action is taken. If the assembly passes the ordinance tonight, it will be subject to voter approval. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson. This is the Borough Assembly story for air Friday, July 14th, in 3, 2, 1. The Assembly talked about the issue for more than 2 hours last night, and in the end, they agreed that the question of finding new office space for the school district should be looked at even more. The Borough Assembly voted to postpone action on a possible bond issue to buy the Teamsters building after hearing from school officials that it might not suit their purposes. There was also concern that the state will not pick up most of the tab for the purchase unless the building is studied more closely. Board member Don Lowell was one of several assembly members who did not want to commit to the Teamsters building yet when other places and costs could be explored.
And I think it's too important to try to jam something down our throat that may or may not be acceptable. We have not notified the community that we're looking for office space. There's other space out there that's available. There's other owners, and let's give them the same option.
And a decision to put off the vote was welcomed by Borough School Board Vice President Gene Redden.
I'm happy we made progress. I mean, at least we'll have some projects in front of us with looking at our specifications and having the cost of what that would require to meet those specifications. So, yeah. I mean, that's progress. We should have been here months ago, but at least we're this far along now.
What the delay does accomplish is likely keep the plan from being an October election issue. Assembly members say they would like to be able to get the matter resolved by the end of August so it could make it on the ballot in October, but meeting that time deadline while exploring all the options is unlikely. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson. This is Golden Days coordinator Valerie Munt in a story which aired on July 13th, 89 on Golden Days in 3, 2, 1.
We need them to turn out and have a good time because Golden Days does not happen without the city. And while we're looking for it to be a short-term economic boost in the middle of summer for the various business owners in the area, what we really want to do is remember our past. And remember the pioneers that settled this place, gave us the values that we have, and everyone came from a different point of view, but they were all working together to build community and build a town. And that's, Golden Days is just an extension of that and an appreciation for those who work so hard.
This is Bob Peterson, who is the park manager at Alaska Land, talking about business so far this year for air on July 11th, 1989.
We don't have the figures in, and because only the RVs have gone up 20 units, I think a lot of that is local visitation. We had the big 4th of July celebration out here and the grand opening of the Native Village, and the place was packed. I have not seen as many folks here as I have on that weekend, so I think the locals are slowly coming back into Alaska land and realizing it's here and what it has to offer.
This is City Council member in Fairbanks, Jerry Cleworth, about an initiative and referendum proposal that he has going on the ballot. It aired on Wednesday, July the 12th.
I think after watching this process for 2 years that we need to clean it up, and it would be nice if we could have a consistency in this area between the city and the borough. I think it's worthy of going to the ballot to eliminate this confusion, as we witnessed just 3 months ago, as to, you know, what's right and what's wrong. I have to admit, when I read it, I was confused myself.
This is Fairbanks North Star Borough Assemblyman Jeff Weltzien on garbage.
We tried a noble experiment 2 years ago. I tried to privatize the landfill and go to a recycling operation, and I felt it was a good effort, and now that the effort is gone full cycle and it hasn't worked, I believe this ordinance is appropriate, it's reasonable, and I think it actually is a least cost approach.
This is Fairbanks businessman Bill Love on a rock oil cleaning solution. It aired Friday, July the 14th, 1989.
Well, I've tried it on oil on asphalt, and it scrubs all the way down to the asphalt, makes it clean, and turns the oil into a cream, into a milky substance. I've tried it on degreasing engines, and it took it right down. I tried it on gravy in a restaurant, brown gravy, and it turns it to white cream, and it cleaned the drain on the way down.
As we drive by during the day, we see the bright orange road construction signs that are left over from the night before. It seems road crews are night owls this time of year for two main reasons. The Department of Transportation Chief Construction Engineer in the Northern Region is David McCallum. McCallum says the night operations are designed by the contractors to have the least impact on the traveling public, and they also can be the most efficient way to run the operation. Take the Steese Highway resurfacing north of Fairbanks to Fox. McCallum says that contract requires the road be open from 7 until 9 in the morning and 4:30 to 6:30 in the afternoon. Those restrictions can cause some problems with a regular workday schedule, so they instead have regular work nights. People doing most of their driving during the day have to deal with inconveniences like pavement breaks, but McCallum says the alternative is a slower traffic flow.
Yes, that is a inconvenience and a little roughness, but at least during the day you're not dealing with the machine out there milling and a lot heavier traffic flow and a lot, you know, trucks, the contractors' trucks and everything else mingled with the heavy flow of the traffic.
McCallum says one local project, resurfacing Airport Way from west of University Avenue to the Gaffney intersection, will likely run through August. Crews are working at night there. On the Geist extension from Pegger Road to the College Connection, some night work is going on at the bridge. McCallum also warns that as it gets darker at night, there is a greater potential for accidents. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson.
Imagine a 700-pound muskox named Percival, or Alfonso, or Bertha. Well, they're all here, munching happily away on hay and chickweed. If you've never seen a muskox, picture a 55-gallon drum covered with extremely shaggy brown and gray carpet, with curled horns sticking out the front end, stubby legs, and wide hooves underneath. And while it may be hard for the casual observer to tell much difference, Muskox Farm Director John McKee and his staff of volunteers have given names to every one of the 103 animals at this farm. The animals were hunted to extinction in Alaska in the late 1800s. McKee says these muskox, another herd on Nunavak Island and a small herd in Fairbanks, are the progeny of 33 animals brought to Alaska from Greenland back in the 1930s. And it's the survival rate of the young calves at the farm that gets a lot of attention. 7 of the 11 calves born last year died. Now the pasture has been reorganized, and this year they also had 11 calves and lost 4. McKee says all but one were runts and starved to death, and one apparently healthy calf had an undeveloped stomach. He says the farm's overall survival rate of almost 80% is about the same or better odds that the animals would have in the wild. McKee says once past the first critical year, when the calves gain a pound a day for the first 3 or 4 months, the animals flourish here. It's the only domestic commercial muskox farm in the world, and domestic is the key word. The Eskimo name for them is Umingmak, meaning the bearded ones, and these are obviously not vicious, wild things. McKee calls the especially tame ones lap oxes. He knows they won't be releasing those animals back to nature.
Got a couple on the farm that, you know, you wouldn't see running around in the wild. They'd be wolf meat.
He says they do have to cut the horns off the bulls to keep them from gouging each other, and they try to keep head bashing to a minimum as the adult males challenge each other for harems. The bulls are capable of killing themselves from brain abscesses when they crash together at a closing speed of about 35 miles an hour. McKee says one bull called Ikpik is about the meanest critter on the farm, and you don't want to get too close to him. But the rest, like Muttley, Sylvia, and Buddha, are as tame as kittens, if a little reluctant to come to the fence for a handful of crabgrass.
Come here, Sylvia. Come here. She might not get up right away. Oh, come on.
Looks good. Looks pretty good.
Muskox live to the ripe old age of only 18 or 20 years, and McKee says his goal is to get a younger average population so the herd can begin doubling in size within the next 2 to 3 years. Even though the farm has had serious problems in the past, McKee says he's not worried at all about the future. He says relations between people and the bearded ones have come a long way since hunters shot entire herds just to get one calf for a zoo. These days, things are much more cordial.
These people, through an auction, bought a steak and steak dinner for two with Rosie and Betty the muskoxen, and we served steak and champagne and baked potato on one side of the picnic table, and we poured pellets out on the other side, and the muskoxen and the people merrily grazed away in their respective fashions on opposite sides of the table.
John McKee, director of the Alaska Muskox Farm. I'm Robert Hawk.
This is the story on 89 Graduates for Air July 18th. In 3, 2, 1. More than half of last spring's graduates plan to go on to college this fall. Getting a job or traveling were the other common answers to a survey conducted by the district's program planning and evaluation director. Nick Stayrook says the school board wanted to know more about its graduates.
Our school board has been very interested in looking at the quality of our graduates, how many people actually graduate, those kinds of things. What do they plan to do after they graduate, etc.?
So Stayrook compiled those statistics for the board. He found that the number of graduates is down. Only 78% of last fall seniors moved on to graduate in 1989, compared to 80 and 85% in the two previous years. Ben Eielson High School has the highest graduation rate at nearly 93%, followed closely by West Valley High School. The Correspondence and Fairbanks Alternative High Schools have the lowest graduation rates. A breakdown by ethnic group shows that nearly 93% of the district's Hispanic seniors graduated. White students had a graduation rate of 82%, blacks were at 76%, and Asians 63%. The graduation rate for Native Alaskans was the district's lowest, 46%. A survey of graduating seniors also showed that about half of the students plan to live and work in Alaska. One-fourth of them plan to return here after going to college in the lower 48, and about a quarter of those surveyed plan to leave the state. Stayrook says the information will help the district see if it's doing its job.
A lot of what information the board had been receiving had been opinions of people about how things are going, or, you know, specific incidences or something occurring in a particular school. What this kind of a report does is it lays out the information for the board so that they can see what's going on in all of the schools using some kind of a consistent metric, so that they can measure progress from year to year.
Stayrook says he plans to continue the surveys on an annual basis. He also plans to do follow-ups, tracking each class 5 years later to see what the students actually ended up doing. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson.
We, like everybody, have to be insured, and for some very big amounts, just in case somebody something should happen and somebody decides a lawsuit is in order, and you know, insurance payments are $800 a month for a short period of time here, so all those things enter into it.
This is a story about Russian visitors that the Chamber of Commerce brought here for air on Wednesday, July 19th in 3, 2, 1.
Olga Polikova is assistant director of the Komsomol, which is a youth organization, the largest organizations, youth organization in the Soviet Union. Gennady Zavolok is the head of all the production for the Magadan region. I'm talking about the whole production because it's a monopoly.
He's Chamber of Commerce.
Steve Zellner is the one who brought the Russians to Fairbanks in order to meet businessmen here. Zellner says Fairbanks was left out when Soviet visitors were in Anchorage last February, and he wanted to bring Soviets from Magadan here since he says Fairbanks is real Alaska. Zellner runs an organization called Slava International. Its job is to drum up business with the Soviet Union. Zellner says since this is the common border between the two superpowers, he feels very good about the chances of Alaska expanding trade into the Soviet Union and about small business possibilities between the two countries. That's why he brought the head of all production in Magadan here. Gennady Zavolov told business leaders that there are 5 joint ventures between Soviet and American businessmen, and he brought a lot of suggestions and new ideas about organizing new joint ventures. He says Alaska and Magadan lead the other states and regions in ties between the two countries. Olga Polikova is interested in bringing artists from Russia here, but she says she expects artists will continue to have success on both sides. She also thinks it's a good idea to exchange groups of young people on both sides. And she's optimistic about the future of openness between the two countries.
And we hope that our future cooperation will be long and everlasting.
The two left with plenty of souvenirs from Fairbanks, armed with pins and literature on things like Golden Days and Doyon. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
That curriculum was argued and debated and pretty much abandoned, and now we're going to go back and take a look at it again.
Hundreds of Eskimos and Indians are expected to compete in the games this year. Carol Pickett has been involved with the games for the last 10 years. Not only is she a participant and a record holder in a high kick event, but she's also on the board of directors. Pickett says the Olympics will have an international flavor again this year.
We are expecting maybe 2 groups of Canadian athletes over to participate with us this year. From what I understand, there's already 4 Canadian athletes with us right now. We were hoping to have Siberian Eskimos come over for an Eskimo dance group, but we haven't heard anything as far as that. We do expect 400 to 600 participants from Alaska.
Pickett says you can expect the usual excitement at the games this year, too. Several dance teams are lined up to perform. Popular events like the ear pull, knuckle hop, and blanket toss will be back. Seal skinning and fish cutting are also on the agenda. Pickett says the events all stem from native games of survival and tests of strength and endurance.
Because the person had to be pretty strong to survive in the Arctic world. And the high kicks are one of the spectator events. And like the 2-foot high kick was a signal when a village of whaling crew was out. Somebody would be standing on the hillside there watching, and when they saw that their crew had gotten a whale or a walrus or whatever, he would turn around and jump into the air, which would signal the village to come help bring it in.
The games began in Fairbanks nearly 30 years ago and are still popular. There is free admission to the preliminary events during the day, but tickets for the evening ceremonies and finals cost $10. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
A large contingent of scientists and technicians are arriving in Alaska, setting up shop for some cloud study. The particular clouds that they're hoping to check out are found somewhere above those that make for gray, overcast days and somewhat below where outer space begins. They're called noctilucent clouds. And if you've ever seen one, it most likely appeared as a silvery ribbon in the sky or maybe even a star. That's because they're found high up where the thin air is very cold. To make sure that they see what they're looking for, the scientific group now in the state will make their own noctilucent cloud. They'll do it with the aid of a Black Brant rocket to be launched from the Poker Flats test range north of Fairbanks. Sometime during the third or fourth week of this month, around midnight, the rocket will be sent skyward, depending upon weather conditions. At an altitude of about 40 miles, material will be released to form an artificial noctilucent cloud, and the analysis will begin. There will be several study teams on the ground, including one here in McGrath, and an airborne observation team working out of Elmendorf Air Force Base in Anchorage. What exactly they'll be looking for isn't clear. That's because certain aspects of the experiment are said to be of a classified nature. The project, reported to be headed up by the Department of Defense, is the exception to the rule at Poker Flats, where the majority of the 222 major launches over the past decade have been for open, general scientific study. In McGrath, I'm Mike Lane.
There was a bill introduced in the Senate. It has not yet moved out of the Senate, and if it dies, it will probably die this next legislature in the Senate. And if it can't get it out of the Senate, that's a very bad omen for it, because it would have a really rough sledding in the House.
But I hope that we do not distract ourselves from the economic issues, from the personal, from the educational issues, and spend next spring just arguing about the symbolism of one thing or another.
But the question is, why haven't we built a new road in the state in the last 20 years? And I think we've had, at times, we've certainly had the money. We don't have excess billions now, but we had excess billions earlier. Why didn't we build them then? I think the obvious answer is there is political opposition to building roads through new areas. That political opposition has to be effectively overcome.
I don't want to make it a practice or a policy call for the state essentially to pay for the extension of local utilities. I know it's been done in the past. We've done a lot of things in the past, particularly when the state was awash with money. We can't do them anymore, and that's one of the places where we decided to draw the line.
I can see that. We surely enjoy your program.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi. Would you sign up to me, please? My name is Cynthia.
Cynthia.
They stood in line waiting to hand him copies of his book to sign. Some wanted the autograph for themselves, but others asked that he address it to their parents, husbands, wives, or children, so the novel would be well read.
Well, you can't really read it. You sort of have to do it in pieces, you know.
Oh, I know, but luckily...
This is not Carl Haas's first trip to Alaska. He was in Anchorage 2 years ago, but this is his first stop in Fairbanks. And so far, he likes what he sees.
It's a lovely northern town, even with the rain, I think. I think I can see the devotion that people have.
Haas had a story or two for most of the fans who turned out at B&B Booksellers to get his autograph. And he didn't just share stories, he also heard a few.
Hi. Hello. It's really a pleasure to meet you. I've been listening to you since I was 7 years old.
My mother
was a big fan.
Hi.
Hi. How are you?
I couldn't afford to buy the book, so I want you just to put this in.
We'll just wipe that one.
I won't tell you.
What's your name?
Jan.
Well, you never know. I had a lady. Thank you. I had a lady. I forgot where it was. She said, "Would you please inscribe this to my dear husband?" I said, "You want me to put down to my dear husband?"
She didn't think of that.
Oh. Hey.
Hi. I have a sister back in Maine who's just in love with you. She says you have the sexiest voice in all the world. So I'm going.
That's my mother's fault, not mine.
So I'm going to give her this for her birthday, which is next month. And I just wondered if you could put "Happy Birthday, Estelle."
Haas is in town for the weekend. He performs tonight at the UAF Davis Concert Hall. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornton.
Coming down in 3, 2, 1.
About 350 athletes and dancers are signed up for this year's games, including a team from Whitehorse, Yukon Territory. Eddie Airy coaches that team in Canadian games and brought a team to Fairbanks last year for the Arctic Winter Games. This summer, the team drove in from Whitehorse.
A lot of hassle in traveling and stuff like that, but you know, after you get here, you kind of forget about everything like that.
Airy is used to the role of coach. It also means he's mother, father, and nurse to the teenage boys he's escorting for the week that they are in Fairbanks. But for him, it's part of a mission.
It's tradition that you have to keep alive. I think it's very important that people or Native kids realize their tradition and be proud of who they are.
Louise Charles of Bethel is now 25 years old and participates in the high kicks and the strength events. She's more concerned about passing the tradition of the games on to younger athletes than winning the events she enters.
Winning is nothing. It's not that important to, you know. I know some of these athletes are here to win. I'm not. I'm just here to enjoy myself, share a little of my culture to everybody else, you know.
Brian Randazzo of Anchorage is 22 years old, and he's back for his sixth year of World Eskimo Indian Olympics. He holds the record in the 1 foot and 2 feet high kicks. He used to hold the record for the Alaska high kick, but that has since gone to the Canadians, who have developed a way of flipping their bodies over to get a few extra inches out of the kick.
I was planning on coming back this year, and I was going to take a vacation, go to Hawaii, but I started thinking about it, and I heard that the Canadians were coming over, and I just had to come back. It's in the blood.
Randazzo hopes more Canadian teams and eventually Soviet teams will participate in the games. But even so, more and more Alaskans are getting interested.
Native culture is not dying out, and this here proves it. It's getting bigger every year, and it's growing, actually. Look at all the tour buses coming out. There are 7 or 8 tour buses out here, and people want to see this. We take this all over the United States. And we can't get enough attention, so the Native culture is definitely not dying. It's strong and thriving.
Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Robin Martin. Drina McIntyre is the general manager of this year's games and had hoped the Soviets would be in Fairbanks by this week.
We had invited 15 to 20 athletes from Siberia, Siberian Eskimos, and as of yet we haven't heard a word, so we don't know.
But McIntyre is not giving up. She says with the opening of the strait to Bering Air and the ties between Nome and Providenia, she's confident there will be Soviets at next year's World Eskimo Indian Olympics.
I'm really hoping that the board will work, I mean, starting the day after the Olympics for the next year on getting them here for the 30th anniversary.
McIntyre says already she's gotten calls from sponsors willing to help fund a Soviet visit. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Robin Martin.
We feel that hunting in national preserves should be a fair chase hunt, and we don't feel that the use of aircraft to locate and land next to wolves and shoot is a fair chase hunt.
The public hearing was on a proposal to permanently ban hunting wolves in national preserves on the same day in which the hunter is airborne. It got the expected support from people who feel that the practice is an unfair method of hunting or those who simply want to protect wolves.
I don't consider it hunting. I consider it slaughter.
Aerial wolf hunting is not fair chase. It is not sport. In many ways, I consider it a disgrace.
The issue of hunting from the air same day is kind of obscene.
In my opinion, the aerial wolf hunting is a scandal. I think it's only a matter of time before the whole state makes it illegal on the same day wolf hunt.
But about half of the 24 or so people who came to testify opposed the National Park Service proposal, and not necessarily because of the wolf hunting issue.
There's one thing that this meeting tonight is not about. It's not about a wolf regulation. What this meeting is about is the National Park Service's dishonesty and noncompliance with federal law and misrepresentation to the American public.
Lynn Levengood is president of the Fairbanks Advisory Board to the Alaska Board of Game. Levengood says it's a matter of the federal government meddling with the state's authority to manage the wildlife on preserves, and most of those who oppose the permanent ban felt the same way.
One of the principal reasons we fought for statehood was to manage fish and game, because we didn't like the way the feds were managing fish and game, and we thought and it's been shown that the state can do a better job. Now the National Park Service is stomping on that.
We in Alaska are accustomed to this kind of Park Service arrogance on issues like this, but that doesn't mean we approve of it.
Again, I don't believe the issue is whether it's ethical or non-ethical to shoot wolves. The issue is whether the state of Alaska has the right to maintain or to regulate its game.
Are we still a union of sovereign states that have surrendered a certain number of their powers to the federal government? Or do we have a federal government that does whatever it damn well pleases in violations of its promises?
The issue is that the National Park Service wants to stop all hunting on the lands in Alaska. And this is just a foot in the door, the first foot that they probably thought they'd get away with, because they have emotional support from people who don't know what about a wolf.
The matter is still up for public hearing in other Alaska cities. Written public comment is also being accepted in Anchorage through August 8th. The National Park Service expects to make a decision on the permanent ban of same-day airborne wolf hunting this fall. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson. Public comment came first. City Council members heard from some citizens that the proposed solutions were not severe enough. Others said the city officials were behaving like a bunch of little kids, and another called it a power play. But the debate is over. An investigation that began 3 months ago, when the city manager's administrative assistant felt that the three city officials had threatened her job, ended with written reprimands for two of the officials, Mayor Jim Nordahl and City Councilwoman Janet Halverson, and a 3-day suspension for City Manager Brian Phillips. The city employee involved, Tony Nigro, got an employment contract that guarantees she cannot be fired until after Nordahl and Halverson's terms on the City Council come to an end. Most council members expressed concern about the incident or the way the investigation was handled. Jerry Norum felt the investigator took some leaps of logic on his conclusions, and Jim Hayes wished that it all could have been resolved without coming to this. And Hayes wanted some answers from Phillips before voting to suspend him.
This matter that's before us involving Tony, do you see where you made your mistake in that?
Oh, yeah.
Do you?
Yes, I do.
Where was that at?
Well, primarily conducting the discussion in a public restaurant. Tony and I should have been certainly either in my office, in her office, or at least on a private phone.
Is that all? Were there any other mistakes made on your part?
Well, in terms of the context of what I have presented to the City Council in written memorandum, I believe on 22nd of May, I've stated the reasons, the basis of the comments that I made, and do not feel that they were unethical, do not feel that they were in violation of the code, and I've talked to Tony at great length about that. I believe that by statements that were made, she perceived that her job was threatened. That was not my intent. I've told her that. But I believe that she felt that her job was threatened, and consequently, she took the action that she felt was appropriate. If I had it to do over again, yes, I'd do it very differently. No question of that. And I regret that it occurred.
Well, good.
And Phillips' administrative assistant, Tony Nigro, says she will carry on with work as usual.
No, I'm not happy about the fact that it had to happen. I am relieved that it's over. I did what I felt like I had to do, because a person should be judged on their own merits, not on whether or not they'll play a political game. And it's a scary situation when you're in and you realize that you're so vulnerable, and I was.
In the end, Mayor Jim Nordahl maintained that he did not violate the city charter. City Councilwoman Janet Halverson, who was censured along with Nordahl, was absent from last night's council meeting. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson.
Even if I get into Seattle, a lot of people would say, well, that was the accomplishment there, but I'm not going to give up. If I got to get there on my hands and knees, I'm going to be in Key West with one red rose on Valentine's Day for a little cancer victim, a little girl. I wanted to start from Point Barrow. But there were no roads, and then the roads to Prudhoe Bay are restricted. So I couldn't do that. So Fairbanks was the highest place up.
Most everyone agreed that there are good intentions behind the ordinance. The good guys want to shut down houses where they believe drug deals and other illegal activities are going on. And that's what the ordinance intends to do. But the plan that was drafted may go a little too far. It states that bawdy, disorderly, and drug-related houses are public nuisances. It also says that the city can basically go after the household belongings or even the property itself, and it gives citizens the power to file complaints with the city that must be acted upon. The ordinance was drafted by City Attorney Herb Cuss, who is currently on vacation. The plan was up for final approval before the City Council this week, but when council members asked Acting City Attorney Jim Mulhall if the plan was workable and would do the job, Mulhall was not enthusiastic.
This ordinance creates, in my opinion, a nightmare for the enforcement authorities. I think its intent is certainly good, and there may be situations in town that are certainly in need of being found to be a nuisance and closed down. In my opinion, there are a number of problems with it.
Those problems, according to Mulhall, are the fact that city ordinance or state statutes already prohibit most of the activities outlined. State statutes also already have forfeiture provisions. The forfeiture proposals in the city ordinance are what have Mulhall most concerned.
Anytime you are attempting to take property from another individual by forfeiture, you are opening up the ordinance to attack under numerous constitutional challenges.
Mulhall told the council the ordinance will not do what it's intended to do, and no one was more surprised to hear it than Mayor Jim Nordahl.
Inasmuch as I'm one of the co-sponsors of this, and I asked the city attorney to draft it and prepare it, this comes as a little surprise.
Can the ordinance be changed to work? Well, Mulhall says if you take the forfeiture provisions out, you can shut down the nuisance. But there's a question now as to whether or not any ordinance is even necessary. Mulhall says he thinks there are sufficient laws on the books now that would allow the city to take action against drug and gambling operations. He says the effect is the same as abating the nuisance, which is what the council is hoping to do. Council members plan to meet next month and talk about the proposal a little more. As for now, the ordinance is still up in the air because, in the words of one councilman, we don't need more paper, we need more action. For KUAC Local News, I'm Ann Thornson.